Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I want you all to know that America today is on bended knee.
On September 14th, 2001, 3 days after al-Qaeda terrorists attacked the United States on 9/11, President George W. Bush traveled to New York City.
The good people of New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut, as we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens.
He stood at the site of the collapsed Twin Towers. The rubble was still smoldering as he spoke to New York's first responders.
I can hear you! I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
That same day, September 14th, 2001, Congress voted on the authorization for the use of military force, clearing the way for President Bush to launch the war on terror and send the United States military into Afghanistan.
I strongly support the will of this president, Congress, and our citizenry to defend ourselves against our enemies with unrelenting force.
Because that is the goal of the terrorist. To instill fear in the American people. But the unity that we will show them tonight should give them a clue that they will not have that success.
And so I would hope that everyone would be involved in praying for this president, recognizing the tremendous burdens that he has and the decisions that he has to make.
We went to our civil Bible, the Constitution, and we said, what does it call for here? And what it called for was the United States Congress to meet its constitutional responsibility to say, Mr. President, we authorize you in the name of the American people to take action.
The vote was 98-0 in the Senate and 420-1 in the House. Only one person in the entire United States Congress voted against what was essentially an open-ended authorization for the use of military force. That person was Representative Barbara Lee of California.
Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're continuing our series, The Longest War, with a conversation with Representative Barbara Lee. We'll talk about that lonely vote she cast in 2001, about how 20 years later, many other Americans share her concerns about forever wars, and about how the past two decades shaped her and the nation she serves. Representative Lee, welcome to On Point.
Nice being with you, Meghna.
I wonder if we could start with 9/11. How well do you remember that day?
Yes, I remember it just as if it were yesterday. I was sitting in the Capitol early, meeting with the administrator of the Small Business Administration, several members of the Congressional Black Caucus and myself, I believe the meeting started at 8 o'clock. And, oh, maybe 8:15, 8:20, 8:30, I received a call from my office saying I should leave the building right away and to evacuate. And at the same time, I heard the Capitol Police shouting to get out of the building immediately. I asked one of our phenomenal Capitol Police officers which way to go, where what was going on, and he just pointed in the direction to run, and that was in the direction of the Supreme Court. So I ran over in that direction and up Pennsylvania Avenue, and I looked around, and I saw all of this smoke. I ran into one of my colleagues, and so he said, well, come on to my house. And as we kept running up the street, kept looking back, and lo and behold, later we learned that was the plane that had crashed into the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. And then as you were seeing the images on television of the smoldering Pentagon, obviously, of course, what happened in New York at the World Trade Center, and then the fourth flight that crashed in Pennsylvania, I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, first of all, it was terrifying. My immediate thought goes to how many people are injured, killed, praying for them. I'm a woman of faith. I pray. And was not sure what to do but watch it on television, and recognizing that this was a terrible, terrible national security terrorist attack, which we learned pretty quickly. But also in looking back, we evacuated because of the notion that Flight 93 was coming into the Capitol. That was the trajectory we were told of Flight 93. And on that flight was my chief of staff, Sondre Swanson's cousin, Wanda Green, from the Bay Area. And I tell you, in looking back 20 years, I shudder at what could have happened had that flight come into the Capitol. But also, I honor and remember those who were killed on Flight 93 because in many ways they saved my life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you speak about the profound emotion. I mean, the whole nation, of course, was experiencing that same fear, anger, shock, as, you know, we as citizens were slowly learning about what happened, who had done it. As a member of Congress, in those first couple days, September 11th, September 12th, September 13th, what were you told and how did you learn about Al-Qaeda and also what the proposed response would be?
Well, let me preface this by saying members of Congress are also human beings, and we feel the same pain that constituents feel and that everybody feels throughout the country when attacks and when people are harmed. And so the first couple of days, we had many briefings, intelligence briefings, some classified, some not. Within 24 hours, it was determined that it more than likely was Al-Qaeda. And then the response, of course, was to begin to develop a response that would bring the terrorists to justice. And that's when the authorization to use military force was drafted.
You know, I'm really mindful that there are a lot of people who are listening to this who weren't even born at the time, right? So September 11th, 2001 happens. The vote for the authorization for the use of military force was just 3 days later on September 14th. So can you tell me a little bit from your perspective, what were those 3 days like? What were you thinking and what were you hearing from your fellow members of Congress?
Sure. Also, let me just say that only about 25% or less of members of the Congress serving today were serving in 2001. And what took place then, of course, members, we went to the Capitol steps. We sang God Bless America. We said we were not going to let terrorists deter us from doing our job. Of course, there were threats to the Capitol and threats all over. You know, planes had stopped flying. And it was a very scary moment because no one knew where and if another attack was going to occur.
God bless America, my home sweet home.
But we were we're determined, just like on January 6th, and I was sitting in the Capitol chambers that day. We were determined we were going to do something, stay at the Capitol, and not let terrorists deter us from our work. And then we began writing, or the, at least the administration began writing this authorization to use force. And it was 60 words. And in essence, it said the president, any president, not just President Bush, but any president, future presidents, can use force in perpetuity against any nation, organization, individual, associated forces, unless it's connected, as long as it's connected to 9/11. Well, it was not specific. It was overly broad. And we talked about that. I mean, I spoke up in the Democratic caucus. I said, this is something that we need to send back. It cannot be this 60-word, overly broad authorization. And I'm paraphrasing now, and I said, because it will set the stage for a perpetual war. And the president will never have to come back to Congress for us to authorize the use of force anywhere in the world if we pass this authorization. Some members agree, but the response was, and understandably, was, look, we can't be partisan, which, of course, I was not being. I knew we had to bring terrorists to justice. I mean, you know, there's no way you cannot respond, but you have to have an appropriate response and understand the costs and consequences and know what you're doing, right, as members of Congress. And you don't make the, and I said, you don't make these decisions when we're grieving, we're in mourning, 3,500 people have died. You know, my background is psychology and psychiatric social work. And one of the first things that you learn in Psych 101 is you don't make hard, serious decisions when you're emotional.
Yeah.
And when you're fearful and when you're anxious. And so during that time, I tried to explain that to members and said, we need more time. You can't just do this in a day or two.
Yeah.
Or three. But bottom line is, everyone said, no, we've got to be unified with the president. We can't be partisan. This has got to be Democrats and Republicans supporting the president, whatever it may be. And this is the time we stand together.
Mm. Well,
and I understood that very clearly.
When we come back, the moment Representative Lee decided to vote against the Afghanistan war and the blowback that followed. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, it's the third part of our series, The Longest War, where we're listening to the impact the 20-year Afghanistan war had on individuals. On September 14th, 2001, 3 days after 9/11, Congress took that vote on the authorization for the use of military force. And the vote was 98-0 in the Senate for the AUMF and 420-1 in the House. And California Representative Barbara Lee was that single no vote in all of Congress. So what's the story of the moment Lee knew for sure that she was willing to be the sole no vote against the Afghan war?
Well, quite frankly, I did not know. I knew that very few would vote against it, but I was settled in voting no myself personally during the memorial service. And I had talked actually to my predecessor, our beloved, the late Congressman Ron Dellums, who actually, well, in the past had chaired the House Armed Services Committee. I worked for him for 11 years. I spoke with several constitutional lawyers. I spoke with my pastor, my family. I talked to colleagues. And I was concerned that more members weren't saying, I'm certain that I'm going to vote yes or no. I then decided at the last minute to go to the memorial service. I was talking with Congressman Elijah Cummings in the cloakroom in back of the chambers. And I decided to go. And once I went to the memorial services and heard Reverend Nathan Baxter, I was really settled in my no vote.
Today we gather to be reassured that God hears the lamenting and bitter weeping of Mother America because so many of her children are no more. Let us now seek that assurance in prayer for the healing of our grief-stricken hearts.
I mean, there was no way, and I wrote that on the program at that moment.
Let us also pray for divine wisdom as our leaders consider the necessary actions for national security.
I wrote down what Reverend Nathan Baxter said. As we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore.
Wisdom of the grace of God, that as we act, we not become the evil we deplore.
I wrote that down.
Let us stand and pray together.
You still have that program?
Somewhere. I'm a hoarder, so it's somewhere. So, I still have what I said on the floor. I just, because let me tell you, Magna, we were supposed to have the vote on Saturday. When we got back from the memorial service, for whatever reason, they decided the vote was going to be on Friday. And so I said, oh, my God. And I was on the Committee of Jurisdiction on the Foreign Affairs Committee. So, you know, generally, it's the Committee of Jurisdiction members who have a chance to speak for a minute or two or three on a bill. So my staff said, you better go get down there if you want to speak. I said, what? Today? Not tomorrow. So I went down and I didn't have time really to write down exactly what I wanted to say. I just started scribbling on a yellow piece of paper.
The gentlewoman from California is recognized for a minute and a half.
Thank you, and I want to thank our ranking member and my friend for yielding. Mr. Speaker, members, I rise today really with a very heavy heart, one that is filled with sorrow for the families and the loved ones who were killed and injured this week. Only the most foolish and the most callous would not understand the grief that has really gripped our people and millions across the world. This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me, however, to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today, so that this does not spiral out of control. Now, I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful, yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. Thank you, and I yield the balance of my time.
Gentlewoman's time has expired.
Members saw me and how I was really agonizing over this vote. I remember
Congresswoman Eva Clayton saying, yeah, you're very troubled, aren't you, by this? I said, yeah, I am. And so I guess my expression showed how troubled I was. But I knew that there was no way as a member of Congress, I'm going to give up my constitutional, I won't even say right, my requirement to represent my constituents in the matter of war and peace. And you do not just give over that authority. I voted no. And then I went back to the cloakroom. I was fine with voting no, but nobody else did. And so everyone kept coming up to me in friendship, telling me I better go change my vote. Don't I know that all hell's going to break loose? I said, no, this is the right vote. But members were telling me, you're going to lose your election. You're going to get killed. You're doing such great work. I remember one of my good friends said, you're doing such great work on HIV and AIDS. We got to have you here. You've got to stay. Go change your vote. So it was out of friendly kind of concern for me that members wanted me to change my vote.
The question is on the passage of the joint resolution. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The quorum is not present. The ayes and nays are ordered. All those in favor vote aye. Those opposed vote no.
It's just not that often that you look at a roll call and you see one no vote in all of Congress. So I'm just wondering, did you get blowback for that vote?
Did I get blowback? Oh, my God. I got blowback to the point where I got death threats. I had to have security round the clock, couldn't travel. Someone actually called my home phone and shot guns into the voicemail. It was horrible. My family was in jeopardy. The blowback was devastating. Mm-hmm. And also what it taught me was that many people don't understand that even in times of the national security crisis, the right to dissent is a Democrat is central to our democracy. Mm. If one believes that our government is not taking the correct position, it's our obligation to offer a different point of view. That's what democracy is all about. An opponent ran against me, one of my opponents, a person who actually had called me and thanked me for the vote, then turned around and ran against me. And she marched in a parade in New York with Rudy Giuliani carrying a sign with me. And the sign had a picture of me smiling in front of the World Trade Towers burning. And the sign said, Barbara Lee hates America. And can you imagine what that generated against me? But, you know, I have to go back to my faith and being a Black woman in America, as Dr. Maya Angelou said, in one of her beautiful poems, And Still We Rise. And so I just had to stand and just keep my faith and keep going.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because I was about to ask you, do you think that for those people who were thrusting their anger on you, that that you were an easier target for them because you're a Black woman in America?
I think so. Black women have been easy targets throughout our history here. Even now, there are many issues, which I won't go into, that people take me on for where other white members, they don't take on. They take me on because I'm an easy target. and so, yes. But also, I have to share a story with you because this is the glass half full. Many know that I supported Kamala Harris for president. So I was a surrogate and went to South Carolina on one of my visits. And I was at a rally and there was security there. And this white guy with a child comes up to me with tears in his eyes, very tall, husky man. And he came right up to me and he said, look, I was one of those who sent you a letter and threatened you. I was one of those who called you a traitor and committed an act of treason over that 2001 vote, that you were the only one to vote no. He said, and he was crying. He said, I wanted my son to see me apologize to you. He said, I am so sorry for what I did. And I came from some rural community in South Carolina to apologize and just say, now I know why you voted no, and thank you.
Well, we're talking with Representative Barbara Lee. She's been in Congress since 1998. She represents California's 13th congressional district. Almost exactly 20 years ago, she cast the only no vote against the authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan. And we're talking with her today about her experience of how that longest war has changed America, really. And Representative Lee, that week is so compressed in terms of the number of decisions that were made that had profound impacts on the next two decades of American life. So I'm wondering if you could just listen with me for a moment, because I'd like to know how much members of Congress, how much you knew about where the Bush administration's focus really was, even as, you know, the rubble still smoldered at the Pentagon and at the World Trade Center. So just listen here for a second, because from 1999 to 2002, Kofor Black was the head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. And at the time, he reported directly to then CIA Director George Tenet, who I know you'll remember very well. So we talked with Kofor Black a while ago about top-level Washington decision-making after 9/11. And there's a moment from my conversation with him that we've never been able to play before, but today is the day. Because, as we mentioned, Congress took that vote on the Afghan War on September 14th, 2001. And the very next day, on September 15th, 2001, there was a war cabinet meeting at Camp David. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was there, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was there, and of course, President George W. Bush. And Kofor Black was also there. And he told us what happened.
This is the one that really took my breath away. I was in Camp David at the war cabinet meeting on the 15th of September. So you're going along and talking about war plans, and Director Tenet, and he's briefing about, you know, the Afghan war plan. So as we're going through all of this, the whole conversation turned, led by former Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, and supported by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, I basically said, you know, this is not the way to go. We should go for the head of the beast in terrorism, and that would be Saddam Hussein. And so then this discussion starts going forward about basically bypass Afghanistan, because DOD likes that because there's nothing to bomb there, really. Where in Iraq, there are lots of targets you can bomb. So they started talking about shifting, going to Iraq. And so, I mean, you know, this went on, and no one raised their hand and said, this is crazy. I'm a CIA guy, so I stuck up my hand. The president said, yes, Kofor. And I said, Mr. President, we were attacked on 9/11 by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein and Iraq have nothing whatsoever to do with this. So, you know, here you got some of the smartest people in the country, right, who are very well informed, and they go off on this tack. So how does that happen? Yeah, I don't know.
That's Kofor Black, who in 2001 was the head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, talking to us about a meeting that happened on the day after Congress took that war powers vote for the Afghanistan war. Representative Lee, did you or any other of your fellow members of Congress, as far as you know, did you have a sense about how much the Bush administration already, just 4 days after 9/11, was focused on Iraq?
Some of us thought about that, but it was just discussion, the what ifs. But we really did not focus on Iraq until maybe a few months later, recognizing that this was coming. I just have to tell you, one of the reasons, again, that I couldn't vote for this was my dad called me. Now, I'm a military brat. My dad was in the military for 25 years. He retired, lieutenant colonel, fought in two wars, in World War II and in the Korean War. And he called me after I voted no, and he said, you cast the right vote. He said, you don't know where in the world this is going to end. You don't know the territory. You don't know the region. You don't know the exit strategy. You don't know the target. You have no information. And then, lo and behold, you have Iraq. And so my father was absolutely right. This was really about Iraq in many ways, the three-day quick response, because when you look at the Iraq resolution, embedded in the Iraq resolution, a reference to the 2001 authorization. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today, I've been trying for years to repeal both of these authorizations. We finally got the 2002 authorization to use force against Iraq repealed in the House, and now it's on the Senate floor, and hopefully Senator Schumer will bring it up. So I'm hopeful that this fall we'll be able to get the 2002 authorization repealed to the president, because he indicated when I brought it to the floor, he indicated through a statement of administration policy that they supported it, that they would sign it into law. Mm-hmm. And I share this because that's the point. So we've spent trillions of dollars in Afghanistan. Untold amounts have been stolen, waste, fraud, and abuse. And we don't know where taxpayer dollars went. We've lost thousands of our brave troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. They made many, many, many sacrifices. And as the daughter of a military officer, I know the impact on families and what families went through. So, yeah, this was about Iraq. And I have a whole story on Iraq that I could tell you when that authorization came to the floor, which was ridiculous.
More with Representative Barbara Lee when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today with California Representative Barbara Lee in part three of our series, The Longest War. Over 20 years, Representative Lee was steadfast in her opposition to the Afghanistan war, and that put her at odds with both Republican and Democratic administrations. So let's just listen to a moment when President Barack Obama talked about expanding the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Here he is in 2009.
Afghanistan is not lost, but for several years it has moved backwards. There's no imminent threat of the government being overthrown, but the Taliban has gained momentum. Al-Qaeda has not reemerged in Afghanistan in the same numbers as before 9/11, but they retain their safe havens along the border. And our forces lack the full support they need to effectively train and partner with Afghan security forces and better secure the population. Our new commander in Afghanistan, General McChrystal, has reported that the security situation is more serious than he anticipated. In short, the status quo is not sustainable.
President Barack Obama in 2009 essentially calling for more money and more troops in Afghanistan. The very next year, in July of 2010, Representative Lee, you were on the House floor, and there was yet another move to provide $58 billion more towards the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And here's what you said in 2010.
It's a shame and disgrace that we cannot support justice long overdue for Black farmers or youth employment programs, or teachers, firefighters, and police officers who need their jobs, or temporary assistance for needy families. Let's not spend another dollar to escalate America's longest war.
Can you tell me about that 2010 time frame, Representative Lee? What was that like?
Oh, boy, good Lord. Let me tell you, as I said earlier, I voted against that authorization because I knew any president, Democrat or Republican, Republican or Democrat or independent, could use it to wage war in perpetuity. And in fact, I think that's it was clear now that there's no military solution in Afghanistan. And I said that early on. If you know the history of Afghanistan, and secondly, we can't nation build. We can't go around the world, Magna, and just think that we're going to impose upon countries our form of democracy and believe that that will work. And so, yeah, I could not support President Obama either in his efforts to add a supplemental of $58 billion. I mean, come on, trillions of dollars have been misspent. And we can cut our military budget, still maintain a strong national security, and look at our domestic priorities in our own country. If, in fact, we have a defense budget that's more balanced with our development and diplomatic budget, which I actually chair the Appropriations Committee that fund on State and Foreign Operations, which fund
Representative
our diplomacy.
I got to ask you, you are just a no holds barred kind of woman, because even just saying we got to cut our military budget, I mean, I can't imagine that making you a really popular woman in Washington.
Well, no, but that what can I say? Remember, I worked for 11 years a chairman of the Armed Services Committee. Believe you me, we have to have a rebalancing of our defense spending, our spending on diplomacy, humanitarian assistance, and development. Again, I chair the Appropriations Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations. I fund our diplomatic initiatives, our humanitarian assistance, education for Afghan women. That's a $62 billion budget. Defense is $740 billion. Don't you think we need a little bit more rebalancing, reimagining, so that we can stop wars, prevent outbreaks of violence, provide for the security of our country in ways that do not require nation building and sending our troops into harm's way? Come on. Yeah, I'll take the criticism, but we've got to keep fighting to make sure that, and I think the public understands, they want their tax dollars better spent.
You know, so in the last couple of questions I have for you, Representative Lee, I really want to get a sense from you about what you think Congress has learned from these past 20 years and what you see about the nation America has become. So for the first part of that, back in March, we actually spoke with Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts, and he talked with us about how he sees more members of Congress are no longer willing to say yes to open-ended authorizations for military force.
Well, we shouldn't. And one of the things we should do is we should repeal the 2001 and 2002 AUMF and the 1991 AUMF. And in the future, if Congress votes on AUMFs, in my opinion, there ought to be sunsets at the minimum. I mean, these should not be allowed to go on forever and ever. You know, presidents are in power for 4 or 8 years. AUMFs that were passed under their administrations shouldn't last, you know, well into several administrations later. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just can't be right.
But I wonder if how Congress operates has changed substantially enough since 2001 to prevent another open-ended AUMF the next time. I mean, God forbid this ever happens, but the next time America gets attacked, because we talked about that incredible emotion, that anger, that desire to do something. Are there breaks in place in Congress now to slow the process down, to make it a more thoughtful march towards war if that happens?
Well, I agree with Congressman McGovern. He's been a great leader, a great partner in our efforts to repeal the 2001 and 2002 authorizations. And again, only 25% or less of Congress currently serving were here in 2001. So we don't know. And so I believe that even now, we have probably more veterans and more national security experts in Congress, and they weigh in. And we're right now working very hard with a group of members across the board in terms of ideology to try to come up with the framework for if, in fact, we had to put forth or consider a new authorization to use force, we would have the guardrails there so they do not become blank checks again. But it's not easy. and the public understands the need to really make sure that our country is secure, but also they're war weary and they don't want to see us using military force as the first option. Well, that's always there, the use of force.
I'm thinking back to what you said on September 14th, 2001, about considering the implications of that vote so that, as you said, the actions of today do not spiral out of control. I mean, that was 20 years ago. So what you said then, lots more people are saying now, but it took them a while to get around to it. I just wonder, Representative Lee, just take a step back with me here for a second. How much do you think the 20 years in Afghanistan and then, of course, Iraq, which followed that, and the war on terrorism more broadly, how much do you think that has changed America?
Well, I think that it has changed America in many ways. First of all, I believe more Americans are aware of our foreign and military policy, our national security strategies, and how they're related to our domestic priorities and their daily lives. I believe Americans really understand how much money and their tax dollars go to wars. And I also believe that the public understands that the threat of terrorism is real and that we must do something to make sure our country is safe. But now I think Americans are beginning to recognize what we've known for many years is that domestic terrorism and white supremacy is the number one national security threat that we have. And that's a fact. And so people are just waking up to that and need to be extremely concerned about January 6th and white supremacists and white nationalism and domestic terrorism. And so I think that now there's an additional fear that people will have if they don't know about it, if they aren't aware of what took place January 6th. People need to know it's a very dangerous moment in terms of domestic terrorism. So you have now Afghanistan, Iraq, national security issues around international terrorism. More members of Congress also, even those who focus more only on domestic policy, now have a global and international perspective. And when I first came to Congress, let me just tell you, in 98, there had been a survey conducted, and it showed that 60%, of members of Congress did not have a passport. I think now we see ourselves as part of the global family. And now with COVID, what affects one affects all. And that's extremely important. Also, I think that unfortunately, people are more skeptical of the government. And I specifically cite Iraq because we were told lies that there were weapons of mass destruction there. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yet we went to war and sent our troops in harm's way, lost thousands of troops based on lies. Actually, during that period, I'll just parenthetically say I had an amendment that said that let's just wait before we invade Iraq and let the inspectors determine whether or not the weapons of mass destruction are there. I only got 72 votes for that. And had the Congress voted to wait, they would have learned and the public would know for a fact there were no weapons of mass destruction. So I share that because I think the public is now more skeptical also, which is really too bad because they should be able to trust their government. But the government has lied to them too many times.
So here's my last question, Representative Lee. You were so perspicacious, if I can use that word, 20 years ago. And that clip that we played, I want to read the last line back to you. You said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. Did the United States become that evil, come close to that evil? How would you evaluate how we responded as a nation to that call that you made on September 14th, 2001?
Sure. Once again, let me just salute and honor our troops because they did everything their country asked them to do. A lot of what I do now is to try to make sure that our young people, our troops are made whole. What happened during the invasions and the occupations and the war is that Afghan civilians and Afghan refugees, and same with Iraqi civilians and refugees, their lives were destroyed in many ways. Maybe 240 some thousand people in Afghanistan were killed. Millions of refugees. And we see this still now happening. And so we can't forget that there was collateral damage. And that's part of the consequence of war. And it's been very, very tragic in many respects. And so we must move forward. And I say that once again, we have to recognize that we always have the military option. That's always on the table. President can always use force in terms of our national defense. But we should not see that as the only or the first option when in fact, we have other tools to use in terms of diplomacy, development, and humanitarian assistance, and ways to really address the issues of war and peace before a full-scale war breaks out. Mm.
Well, you've been so generous with your time. This has been a remarkable conversation. I thank you so much. And you've given 20 years of interviews about this. But is there anything you've never been asked that you wish you were, or something that I should have asked you today, or something else that you want to say? Just give you a chance here.
Well, I'm thinking of my late mother, Mildred Parrish Massey, and my mother, of course, supported me and knew that that was the right decision. I mean, she, again, had been a military wife. And my mother said to me once, those people who tried to change your mind or who tried to jam you and tell you that that was not the right vote, they should have called me and I would have told them how stubborn you are and how when you make your mind up, unless there's something that really can change your mind, that you're there and won't move. But you're open if you see new information come in. And so my mother could have, she says, tell them to call me. And I miss her so much, but she was right there for me. And she wanted to take some of the heat by having those who came after me to call her.
Well, Representative Barbara Lee has been in Congress since 1998. She represents California's 13th congressional district. And again, back in 2001, she was the only member of the House or the Senate to cast a no vote on authorizing the Afghanistan war. And we've been talking to her this hour about how that experience and the 20 years that followed of the longest war has changed America and her as well. So, Representative Lee, it's been a great privilege. Thank you so very much.
Nice being with you.
Tomorrow, it's the last episode of our series, The Longest War, and we're going to take a look at how young Afghans feel about the future of their nation now. More than 60% of Afghans are under the age of 25. The U.S. military was in the country for 20 of those 25 years. So the framework for their entire lives is changing right now. What impact could they have on the next 20 years in Afghanistan? You heard a veteran say yesterday on this show that he thinks the Taliban won't be able to cope with what young Afghans will demand because they cannot turn the clock back on progress. Do you believe that? Especially if you or your family are from Afghanistan, of any age, call us at 617-353-0683 and let us know what you think, what you want for Afghanistan now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.